Sooner or later, you can bet your life that every Jew in this building is going to say the same thing. He's a little too Jewish for my taste.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Two Jewish is Kenneth L. Marcus, author of the new book, The Definition of Antisemitism. We'll also have a visit from our Two Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our Mavina on Israel, Oshrat Barel. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. As this Jewish year ends, there's a huge humanitarian crisis taking place in Europe, and it's finally getting on the news here in America. It involves the gigantic flow of migrants from the Syrian civil war, which has produced upwards of 3 million refugees, as well as large groups of people from Iraq fleeing ISIS, perhaps 3 million more people, and many refugees from Afghanistan escaping its perpetual war and chaos. In addition, refugees are pouring into Europe from Eritrea and the Horn of Africa by the tens of thousands, while others continue to come from war-torn Somalia and Islamist-threatened Nigeria. In the last year, over a third of a million refugees, more than 350,000 human beings, have tried to enter the European Union, seeking asylum and a new life in the developed countries of Europe, particularly those with a strong economy like Germany. Many have tried to cross the Mediterranean in boats, usually overloaded. Thousands have died when these boats capsized or sunk, most famously a small Syrian child recently. The vast majority of these refugees are Muslim, fleeing Islamist militias, extremist groups, and violent terrorists in their home countries. The images we've seen in recent days of immigrants forced into holding camps, placed on trains with no exit allowed except at these camps, having their names and even registration numbers written on their arms in indelible ink. They should remind all Jews of the Holocaust. In fact, this current crisis marks the greatest refugee problem the developed world has experienced since the end of World War II. In addition, there have been violent anti-immigrant actions taken by some neo-Nazi and far-right groups in Austria, Hungary, and Germany so far, and more are anticipated as this crisis grows. I can tell you that this refugee problem did not suddenly come out of thin air this past summer. When I was in southeastern Turkey in early February, in Şanlıurfa, about 15 miles or so from the Syrian border, there was a gigantic refugee camp in the town of Haran, next town over. That's our patriarch Abraham's city in biblical times. The camp in Haran was filled with refugees, mostly men who were fleeing ISIS. The estimate given of its size was 500,000 people at the time, 500,000 in February. I am sure it is larger today. The reason it was mostly men was because ISIS was forcing men into its ranks or killing them if they refused. The women and children were mostly being left behind to protect property and homes in the belief, correct or not, that ISIS would, at least at that time, not murder Muslim women and children. This was likely not accurate. The accounts of serial rapes, for example, perpetrated by ISIS are now legion, but it was the best these Syrians could manage to figure out as a way to try to save some semblance of their lives. All of which raises a rather gigantic question. Just what the heck has the United Nations been doing about this enormous refugee crisis over the past year? And where is the viral outrage on the internet up until now? Where is the outrage in the world community or on our college campuses over the incredible brutality that has forced millions of human beings into mortal peril, leaving behind everything as they flee for their lives? Well, it's simple, really. The UN, the most significant international body charged with responsibility for refugees and the situations that create them, has spent most of its time this past year, as it does every year, focused on attacking Israel. During the last year, the UN General Assembly passed 23 resolutions. 20 of them condemned Israel. 3 of them, three addressed all the problems of the rest of the world. None of them, for example, talked about Ukraine or Crimea. While this enormous intercontinental crisis was brewing, involving millions of migrants on three continents, Asia, Africa, and Europe, the most authoritative international body designed to deal with such crises, the UN, was too busy condemning a small democracy and focusing on the admittedly difficult plight of the Palestinian people. Deplorable as a situation can be for many Palestinians, most today are living on their own land, in their own homes. They have food, water, sanitation, health care, education, assistance from a wide variety of NGOs, and free access to world media. Not so the refugees from Syria, Iraq, and Afghanistan. While continuing to whip itself into a frenzy over the Palestinians, the UN has essentially ignored the desperate plight of millions of people in the same neighborhood. I am reminded of a statement a rabbi I worked with many years ago, John Kendall, said, "Why is it that an Arab life only matters when it is taken by a Jew?" Why indeed? By the way, those three UN resolutions that dealt with problems in the rest of the world included a condemnation of the situation of human rights in the Islamic Republic of Iran, a second one condemning human rights in the Syrian Arab Republic, that's Syria, of course, and the situation of human rights in the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, that is, North Korea. But no initiatives were launched to help the people in those countries. Many were set in motion, on the other hand, to assist the Palestinians. Here's the real question. Why have so many Muslim countries shut their doors to these refugees? While huge numbers of those fleeing Syria have found refuge in Lebanon, Jordan, and I can vouch for Turkey, what of the oil-rich Gulf states, the most wealthy countries in the Arab world? They have welcomed none. Apparently, Arab solidarity ends for the Gulf Arab states like Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and the Emirates, when they export Islamist terror, not when they invite refugees fleeing for their lives to escape it. The continent of Europe, richest and most developed one in the world, also was distracted and unable to see this humanitarian disaster developing. It was focused on a Greek economic meltdown and on pretending to act concerned about Ukraine being progressively dismembered by Russia. Like the American press, the European media was also focused on the terrible aftereffects of the Gaza war last summer. Those have been prolonged by a failure to get aid in and for the Palestinians to allow the aid to take place. Europe has been unable to see the exponentially greater disasters metastasizing in Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan, and Eritrea until the human flotsam from all of them began to wash up on European shores. Even then, it has taken many months for the organized authorities to begin to think about a coping strategy beyond erecting more barbed wire fences. You know, if I could have just one wish come true in this coming new year, which begins at sundown tonight with the evening of Rosh Hashanah of 5776, it would be that this time the civilized world, including Europe and the U.S., figures out a way to assist refugees and to try to restore justice and peace to their homelands. We managed it once, just after World War II, when conditions were far worse. You would think we could manage it now in the year 5776, September of 2015. We have a space probe sending us back photographs of Pluto, for heaven's sake. Why can't we figure out how to help these poor people? Well, Rosh Hashanah is a time of turning and returning, of tshuva, of restoring what has been damaged in the past year. Maybe it's time to do that now in our world. To play us in this morning and to get us in the mood for Rosh Hashanah, here's an unusual mashup of High Holy Day melodies by the a cappella group called 613. Nine, 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 nine That was the group 613 singing their Rosh Hashanah mashup in preparation for the Jewish New Year 5776, which starts at sundown tonight. When we come back in a few moments, we'll meet our guest, author Kenneth L. Marcus, whose new book from Oxford University Press is called The Definition of Anti-Semitism. We'll explore its origins and its current virulence when we return right here on Too Jewish.
Everything you ever wanted to know about Judaism but were afraid to ask. Temple Emmanuel's famous Taste of Judaism program, now in its 16th year, offers an exploration of Judaism in 3 2-hour sessions on Jewish spirituality, values, and community, taught by our rabbis. Call 327-4501 for more information and to register today. Taste of Judaism is an exciting opportunity to learn about Jewish culture, history, rituals, and practice. The classes are free and open to all, and we feed you too. We have daytime and evening classes in Central, Northwest, and East Tucson, and this year in Suarita as well. In partnership with the Tucson Hebrew Academy, the whole family can learn at the Taste of Judaism family class. And we're thrilled to offer American Sign Language Interpretation, ASL, for one of the sessions. Remember, there are no fees or obligations, but space is limited and pre-registration is required. Call Mila at 327-4501 or email mila@templeemmanueltucson.org. That's Taste of Judaism, 520-327-4501, a fun way to learn about Judaism. Don't miss it.
Are you or a loved one facing a terminal illness? Casa de la Luz Hospice offers patients and loved ones the support necessary to face the final months of life. Paid for by Medicare and most private insurances, hospice team members provide medical, emotional, and spiritual care in the security and comfort of the patient's home. Casa de la Luz has been a leading provider of hospice care in Tucson since 1998, and today serves more patients in Pima County than any other local hospice provider. The mission of Casa de la Luz Hospice is to provide superior care to patients and their loved ones so that they may complete their mission on this earth in comfort, dignity, and harmony. Call 544-9890 to learn more about how Casa de la Luz Hospice can help you. That's 544-9890. Casa de la Luz Hospice, because every day counts.
We are delighted to welcome to Too Jewish our guest this morning. Kenneth Marcus is president and general counsel of the Louis D. Brandeis Center for Human Rights Under Law and author of a variety of award-winning texts, including Jewish Identity and Civil Rights in America, and his new book on anti-Semitism called The Definition of Anti-Semitism. Good morning and welcome to Too Jewish.
Good morning. It's good to be here.
What prompted you? You've been working in anti-Semitism for a while, which is a funny thing to say to somebody, in a variety of roles, Civil Rights Commission and so on. Tell us what prompted you to write this book now.
The biggest single problem we're facing in public policy is the failure of government agencies and universities to understand what anti-Semitism is. Even when they are resolved to fight anti-Semitism, they can't figure it out, especially when it has anything to do with the state of Israel.
I took a class many years ago in anti-Semitism from an excellent professor at Hebrew Union College, Michael Meyer, and we spent, I think, 2 classes defining anti-Semitism. How would you define anti-Semitism?
Michael Meyer is a real distinguished figure, so you were learning from the best. Anti-Semitism is essentially what you think it is, which is to say it is hatred and discrimination against Jews, but figuring out how it applies in difficult areas like anti-Zionism, that's where the trouble is.
There have been many, many incidents on college campuses, including one of my alma maters, UCLA, in the past year. It seems to be picking up all over America. You can say anything negative you want about somebody if they are supposed to be pro-Israel. Is that an anti-Semitic act?
It sometimes is, and certainly the problem facing student Rachel Beda at your alma mater was an anti-Semitic incident, and that one, where the Louis D. Brandeis Center was involved, a student was questioned about how she could impartially serve on a student judicial conduct board if she's a member of the Jewish community. There are no ifs, ands, or buts about that. That's anti-Semitic.
Is anti-Semitism, then, hatred of Jews because they are Jews?
Yes, although it's a little trickier than that, because the fact is that people don't hate Jews because of what it means to be Jewish. People hate Jews because of misperceptions about what it means to be Jewish. Some people have said that it means hating Jews as not Jews, by which they mean hating Jews because of some sort of a mythic idea, a false mythic set of stereotypes about what it means to be Jewish.
We will continue to explore what anti-Semitism is with Kenneth L. Marcus, the author of The Definition of Anti-Semitism, when we come back in just a few moments here on Too Jewish.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
We welcome Pam and David of Freedom Smoke. So your product, a smokeless way to get off of tobacco, people don't really understand exactly what's wrong with cigarettes, or they think it's the same thing that's wrong with your product. Can you explain the difference?
That's true, Rabbi Kohan. Part of it is the cigarettes themselves, the FDA made them release the ingredients. There's over 3,000 ingredients in cigarettes. There's four ingredients in electronic cigarettes. Propylene glycol, vegetable glycerine, flavorings from FlavorArt in Italy, who is who we use, and nicotine itself. Our nicotine is USP hospital grade. It's the finest that you can purchase. Nicotine in and of itself is not harmful to the human body. That's why we have so many doctors referring patients that they just cannot get to quit smoking cigarettes. They send them to us for a much healthier alternative.
And where do people go and how do they find your stuff?
They can go to one of our three stores here in Tucson. We've got one at Orange Grove and River, one at Broadway and Swan, and one at 12th and Valencia. Or they can go online to freedomsmokeusa.com.
Thanks very much, and we'll talk next week.
Always a pleasure.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit our website at twojewishradio.com, T-O-O, Jewish Radio. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, streaming them at twojewishradio.com or download us at the Apple iTunes Store as popular Jewish podcasts. We welcome our Mivina in Israel, Oshrat Barel, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov, Oshrat, and Lashana Tova.
Boker Tov, Rabbi, Shana Tova, Umetuka.
A good and a sweet year coming up tomorrow, tonight. It's a good time to think not only about ourselves, but in thinking about Israel, I think it's a good time to talk about leadership and what leadership means. You know, as we enter a new year looking for a new perspective, Bibi Netanyahu's been the Prime Minister of Israel now for a long time. Many times it looked like he wouldn't remain. He has remained. I think it's worth talking about what his leadership means in Israel, what the different perceptions are of him.
I will start from the beginning, okay? Like if we see like the Israel history, okay? And we can see that all the, you know, prime ministers and the Jewish leaders, not just the prime ministers, those who really we still have in our memory, like, you know, if it's Ben-Gurion and if it's Begin and if it's, you know,
Golda
even
Rabin,
Golda Rabin. Those who really, you know, you will mention their names, like you will remember them by heart for their leadership. Like, you know, sometimes their name related to Chas v'Chalila scandal, but
scandals, right?
But sometimes to a big success. Like if we started with Ben-Gurion, without his, you know, courage and you know, vision. First of all, vision. And a lot of courage. I don't know if
I would have
Israeli passport today.
Right.
But so if we're talking about Bibi, who is the first prime minister, by the way, that in the Israeli history, that he's the third time prime minister.
Yeah, third term.
And And if, I don't know, if you check, just for, you know, for the record, I would say that I grew up in a home that my father was Likudnik and supported Bibi, and my mother supported labor. So I'm kind of, you know, chatsuya.
Very Israeli. Very Israeli. Your mom supported labor, yes, your dad supported Likud.
Yeah. So I will use my dad's words that say that he really appreciated Bibi, but he's not like the real Chirutnik leaders
like Begin, Sharon.
And Jabotinsky, even though Jabotinsky wasn't the prime minister, but he was one of the
great,
you know,
leaders,
the philosophy,
the founders
behind
of the,
Chirut, right, is Jabotinsky.
And Chirut, of course, was the founding party that eventually led to the Likud coalition.
Yeah, and we're still saying the Chirutnik, you know, the real Chirutnik. So, yeah, Bibi led some very important, I would say, processes, not just, I'm talking about interior subject, not just, you know,
foreign affairs, right?
Foreign. But in terms of foreign affair, you know, he decided to be very protective from the very beginning. And it's not all the time proven, like, to be the right approach. And,
It's interesting because sometimes in his extreme turn towards security, towards bitachon, always worried about Israeli security, he may have missed some very serious opportunities. And I think that's one of the things that even Likudniks will say about Netanyahu. Very bright man, but
he's very bright and very smart. And I was listening during last summer to all kind of his,
articulate.
Yeah. When he spoke, like, even in the 70s, when he was an MIT student. So from his early days and a young politician, I would say, that's the approach. And many of the Israelis and Jewish around the world really, really appreciate him for the fact that he kind of, you know, protect Israel from everyone. And others, you know, would appreciate much more, you know, again, courageous, I would say.
Courageous opportunity to take a chance on peace, even sometimes.
You need to take a chance. I'm Ez Menatzeach. The one who takes chances.
A good message as we enter the new year. Thanks so much, Ashrat. Shana Tova.
Shana Tova.
As we conclude this Jewish year, we welcome back an unpredictably recurring feature of Too Jewish, Zen Judaism. Take only what is given. Own nothing but your robe and an alms bowl. Unless, of course, you have the closet space. And to practice Zen and the art of Jewish motorcycle maintenance, do the following. Get rid of the motorcycle. What were you thinking? Those were two koans from the eternal wisdom of Zen Judaism. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom. Rosh Hashanah is here. L'shana tova. Good New Year.
Also to you.
You just came back from a variety of places, but Budapest was one of them.
Right. So Budapest is kind of special in the panoply of Eastern European capitals because deportations to concentration camps didn't begin till fairly late in the war.
1944,
I think. A lot of Hungarian Jews survived, and the communist regime in Hungary was not as harsh on Jewish institutions as many others. So a lot of synagogues never stopped functioning. The only rabbinical school in the communist world during the Cold War years functioned in Budapest. There was a bar mitzvah almost every week, sometimes more than one. There were numerous synagogues in Budapest itself, and, you know, maybe one per major city in the rest of the country.
They even have their own flavor of Jewish movement in the Neolog movement there.
Right.
A really unique Jewish community.
Right. So the sort of Hungarian Jewry never really ceased to exist in the same way that many other Eastern European Jewries virtually ceased to exist. I mean, they're being revived now by Chabad and others. Even the Reform Movement has outposts in some places in the former communist world.
It does.
But it's kind of like resuscitating somebody who's drowned. It hasn't really been a continuous, dynamic Jewish existence or Jewish presence in some of these places. Budapest is the exception. And there's, you know, as you know, there's a huge Jewish museum. But what's interesting now, and what struck me on this visit more than ever before, is the most in place to go for, like, yuppies, young lawyers, people 20 and 30 somethings with little money and well-traveled and, you know, multilingual people is the old Jewish ghetto, which is near the synagogue.
The Doheim
synagogue.
Where
there's stuff in ruins that they've opened cafes and restaurants. And the most popular restaurant among non-Jews, among people who don't know what it means, and it's not even a kosher restaurant, there's a restaurant called Mazel Tov. And everybody goes there. And, you know, the Hungarian friend who was with us and said, let's go to dinner here. I said, do you know what that means? He said, no, I don't have a clue. It means something? He thought it was just like random letters. There's not a Jewish guy. I told him what it meant. He said, oh, that's cool. He said, well, they are having good luck because it's a very successful restaurant. You usually have to get reservations 2 or 3 weeks in advance, but I know the manager, so we can probably go at very short notice. Unfortunately, our plans for going out that night were ruined by a torrential downpour. Budapest had a record rainfall. Metro stations were closed. There were like 3 feet of water in the streets. Half of my Hilton was evacuated. So we didn't actually go to the Mazel Tov restaurant. But what was interesting to me was that this area around the synagogue is now the center of nightlife for cool, hip people.
Really interesting. Reminds me, though, in a different way of having been in Krakow and seeing this tremendous, there's an actual interest in Judaism and Jewish life, and almost none of the people that are so interested in it are actually Jewish.
Right.
It's a fascinating, odd phenomenon, not something you could have ever predicted.
Right. That Poland altogether is a country where Jewish life almost disappeared. It was just a little flicker in Warsaw and Krakow, and that's about it. But non-Jews have formed klezmer bands and major in Yiddish and are really reviving Jewish culture because they feel that part of their history and the fabric of their society is missing. So in many cases, somebody with one Jewish grandparent or great-grandparent studies, converts, and revives locally or contributes to the revival of a local Jewish community in Poland. So that is also very interesting.
Well, fascinating stuff. L'shana tova, tikatevu v'techa temo.
Also to you and your listeners.
Thanks, Tom. When we return on To Jewish, we'll hear the old Jewish joke of the week.
Is your aging loved one unhappy and having a hard time adjusting to life around them? The TMC Jarrow Psychiatric Center at Handmaker may be able to help. TMC Jarrow Psych specializes in providing short-term, inpatient services for older adults experiencing behavioral health issues. Did you know that most people with depression get better when they seek help? With the right treatment, those with anxiety can overcome and learn to cope with their fears, and individuals with dementia can continue leading quality lives. Our team, led by a geriatric psychiatrist, brings expertise from disciplines across a variety of specialties to ensure your loved one receives the right diagnosis and treatment. For more information about our services, please call 324-4600. The TMC Jarrow Psychiatric Center at Handmaker. Call 324-4600. Let's talk about how we can help.
My name is John Ben Asher, and I'm the head of school at the Tucson Hebrew Academy. Tucson Hebrew Academy is a pluralistic kindergarten through eighth grade Jewish day school. We foster educational excellence through an interdisciplinary, integrated general studies and Judaic curriculum. We teach our students to apply Jewish values and learning to everyday life, enabling them to make their community and the world a better place. Our engaging, talented faculty ensure a rigorous, interactive, supportive learning environment. From the early years through comprehensive high school prep, children thrive in THA's uniquely enriching educational community and culture. Our 41-year tradition of excellence continues to produce highly skilled, critical, and creative thinking students with a strong moral compass and deep understanding of Jewish identity, traditions, and values, well prepared for the challenges to come. Tucson Hebrew Academy, thaaz.org, 529-3888.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
The Temple Emmanuel pilgrimage trip to Israel with me, Rabbi Sam Cohan, is set May 29th to June 9th, 2016. If you're interested in going on this fantastic journey to Israel, seeing it all from Tel Aviv to Haifa to Tzfat to the Sea of Galilee to amazing Jerusalem, please email tojewishradio18@gmail.com or call 520-327-4501 for more information and an itinerary. It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week, Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a Public Service. Since it's the very end of the year, we have a veritable bonanza of Jewish waiter jokes, two classics from the late, sort of great, Henny Youngman, and one more from my own dad, Baruch Cohan. A man calls over the waiter in a kosher restaurant and asks him indignantly, "Waiter, what's this fly doing in my soup?" And the waiter answers, "The backstroke." Another man calls over the same waiter and says, "Waiter, what's this fly doing in my soup?" And the waiter answers, "There was no room left in the potato salad." And finally, a man calls over the waiter at a kosher restaurant and tells him, "Waiter, taste my soup." And the waiter says, "Sir, is there something wrong with the soup?" And the man says, "Taste the soup." The waiter says, "Is the soup cold?" The man says, "Taste the soup." The waiter says, "Look, what is it? Is the soup too salty?" The man says, "Taste the soup." The waiter says, "I don't need to taste the soup. Look, if there's something wrong with the soup, I'll get you a new bowl." And the man says, "Taste the soup." Finally, the waiter says, "Okay, have it your way. Where's the soup spoon?" And the man says, "Aha!" Those were the old Jewish jokes of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well and enjoy your soup, especially the chicken soup for Rosh Hashanah. And now a word of Torah. This week we'll hear both the Rosh Hashanah reading in Temple as well as our Shabbat Shuvah, the Sabbath of Repentance Torah portion of Vayelech, next Saturday. The two portions are actually connected by an odd and important element: the closeness of death. The Rosh Hashanah Torah reading, of course, is the tale of the binding of Isaac, the Akedat Yitzchak, read in Reform congregations on the morning of the first day of Rosh Hashanah and in conservative and Orthodox synagogues on the morning of the second day of Rosh Hashanah, which Reform congregations don't celebrate. The binding of Isaac deals with the great and painful story. God commands Abraham to sacrifice his only son Isaac on the altar as a kind of human korban, an offering to God. While the sacrifice itself is averted at the last moment by the intervention of an angel, and a ram caught by its horns, its shofarot in a nearby bush, is substituted for Isaac, it is still a powerful and troubling tale. Our Shabbat Shuvah portion of Vayelech, near the end of the Torah, in the very last stages of the book of Deuteronomy, tells of the final days of Moses, his last instructions to the people of Israel he has led for so many challenging years. In Rosh Hashanah's Torah reading of the Akedat Yitzchak, Abraham is told to sacrifice his son, but the killing is actually averted. But in the Shabbat Shuvah Torah portion of Vayelech, the killing, that is, the death of Moses, will come. The connection in this season of judging is to Rosh Hashanah, the Yom HaDin, a day in which we dress in the white clothing of the shroud and face our own personal judgment day. For on Rosh Hashanah, like Abraham and unlike Moses, we have the chance to avert an evil decree, the opportunity to turn a kind of spiritual death sentence into a renewed message of hope, renewal, and spiritual cleansing. May this week's Torah readings help us to find our own message of life and truth, compelling us to look at the possibility of our own passing, because when we face death, we learn to value life and to live as though it really matters. When we return in a moment here on Too Jewish, our guest, Kenneth L. Marcus, will explore the origins and current contemporary meaning of anti-Semitism. His new book is from Oxford University Press. We'll find out how anti-Semitism continues to evolve and what a real danger it presents today when we come back in a few moments here on Too Jewish.
Hi, Doris. How are you?
Well, Carol, to be honest, now that I'm a little older, I can't get out as much as I'd like. I miss seeing people.
Why don't you come over to my place for lunch on us? The food's delicious. So many choices. And I have a special table with my friends every day. They'd love to have you join us.
Is there much to do there?
There are lots of activities every day. Mondays is Mahjong. Tuesdays, I do yoga. Wednesdays, we go shopping or to the museum or a restaurant. Thursdays, my exercise class. There are book groups, speakers, Shabbos services, concerts, a game room. I'm busier than ever.
Where do you live?
I'm at Handmaker. And the people are great. Please come over for lunch. You'll love it. It's even kosher. Just call me at 322-7035.
Handmaker Jewish Services for the Aging offers the full spectrum of quality senior living and post-hospital rehabilitative care. Call 322-7035. Handmaker for life. 322-7035.
Are you or a loved one facing a terminal illness? Casa de la Luz Hospice offers patients and loved ones the support necessary to face the final months of life. Paid for by Medicare and most private insurances, hospice team members provide medical, emotional, and spiritual care in the security and comfort of the patient's home. Casa de la Luz has been a leading provider of hospice care in Tucson since 1998, and today serves more patients in Pima County than any other local hospice provider. The mission of Casa de la Luz Hospice is to provide superior care to patients and their loved ones so that they may complete their mission on this earth in comfort, dignity, and harmony. Call 544-9890 to learn more about how Casa de la Luz Hospice can help you. That's 544-9890. Casa de la Luz Hospice, because every day counts.
We continue with our Two Jewish Update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
On the eve of the Jewish New Year of Rosh Hashanah 5776, there are now over 8.4 million people living in Israel, their Central Bureau of Statistics reports. Since last Rosh Hashanah, Israel's population has grown by 158,000 people, almost a 2% increase. Jews now make up 6.3 million of the population of Israel, just under 75%. There are 1.75 million Arabs, about 21%, and 366,000 other residents, another 4.4%. The Statistics Bureau forecasts that Israel's population will reach 10 million by the year 2030. Over the last year, while 168,000 babies were born in Israel, 42,000 people died. Net migration into Israel over the last year was about 32,000. Of this number, 28,000 were Jewish Olim, representing a 35% increase from last year. Most of them came from Ukraine, France, Russia, and the U.S. In spite of all the negative press about Israel, it is quite obvious that far more people want to live in Israel than want to leave. In tragic news, the mother of an 18-month-old boy and his father, who died in the horrific arson attack in the West Bank, has also died of her burn wounds. Raham Dawabsheh's condition took a turn for the worse last week after spending 5 weeks on life support in the intensive care unit of Sheva Medical Center, Tel HaShomer. She suffered third-degree burns on 90% of her body during the firebomb attack in the West Bank village of Duma on July 31st that killed her son Ali and, critically, fatally wounded her husband. Her husband Saad died a week after the attack from those burns. A 4-year-old son, Ahmed, who suffered second-degree burns on 60% of his body, is still living. He, too, is hospitalized at Tel HaShomer's burn unit. The arson attack, attributed to Israeli extremists and labeled Jewish terror by top Israeli officials, fueled unrest in Israel and the Palestinian territories and prompted the government to crack down on far-right extremists. In other news, in the Netherlands, the city of Amsterdam will compensate descendants of Holocaust survivors fined for not paying their rent on time while they were incarcerated in Nazi camps. Starting today, the family's descendants can get reimbursed for the penalties exacted for overdue rent payments during the Second World War, which were unfairly collected, said a statement issued by Amsterdam last week. The average compensation is supposed to be $1,800, but it'll vary according to the case. The affair first made headlines last year when a historical study discovered that hundreds of Dutch Holocaust survivors who came back to Amsterdam after the war were forced to settle overdue bills, city taxes, and fines accumulated while they were in concentration camps or in hiding. The study, authored by the NIOD Institute for War, Holocaust, and Genocide Studies, found 200 cases. Even Jews who returned from Auschwitz were required to pay the bills, including gas bills that were unpaid by squatters who lived in Jewish property during the war. The study was initiated a few years ago when a Dutch student working part-time at the Amsterdam Archives came upon unusual documents, letters sent by survivors to the municipality in which they complained about having to pay bills and fines sent to homes stolen from them. The student, Charlotte Vandenberg, said, "I felt these documents were too important to just let them lie there. It's an injustice, not something you can just set aside and forget." Among the documents cited by the study were the municipality's responses to the letters of complaint. The base payments and the late penalties have to be paid regardless of whether a third party, legally or not, held the property for a while, read one response. Another read, "The municipality has the right to receive full payment for the bills and penalties." Yeesh. According to Yad Vashem, about 140,000 Jews lived in the Netherlands when the Germans invaded the country in May of 1940. The deportation of Jews to the Nazi camp started in the summer of 42. Most of them were deported to Auschwitz and Sobibor. The final tally of Jews deported stood at 107,000 in 1944 when the last transport was sent. Only 5,000 Jews returned to Amsterdam after the war. Over 75% of the Netherlands Jews were murdered in the Holocaust. And in college football news, there is a new best Jewish quarterback on the scene, and he is a UCLA Bruin. Josh Rosen, a 6'4" true freshman who was the nation's top recruit last year, completed 28 of 35 passes for 351 yards and three touchdowns as UCLA whipped Virginia 34-16. He was honored as the Walter Camp Offensive Player of the Week. Born in Manhattan Beach, California, Josh Rosen's father is a spine surgeon, a fine Jewish occupation, and all you have to do is look at Rosen to see the map of Jerusalem on his face, and he can really play. A major new addition to the not-very-large book, Great Jewish Athletes. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews Around the World. We welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning. Kenneth L. Marcus is the author of the brand new book, The Definition of Antisemitism. He's the President and General Counsel of the Louis D. Brandeis Center for Human Rights Under Law and author of the award-winning Jewish Identity and Civil Rights in America. His most recent book, the current one, is published by Oxford. He has a distinguished career already. He was the Lillian and Nathan Ackerman Chair in Equality and Justice in America at Baruch College at City University of New York and the staff director of the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights. Antisemitism has gone from being a declining issue for American Jews to, there's been a sea change. It seems to be increasing. Is that just our perception? Is it real?
In America, anti-Semitism declined precipitously from the end of World War II until roughly the beginning of this new century. Somewhere in the early years of the new century, around the onset of the Second Intifada, something strange happened. It was perhaps a leveling off. I think it will probably take us a few years to say whether there has been a blip, a spike in anti-Semitism, and what I hope will be a continued downward trend. But at this point, it's hard to say. My fear is that we could be seeing a reversal and that the long decline in anti-Semitism is headed the other way.
My good friend Leonard Dinnerstein, who wrote Anti-Semitism in America,
was on this program. I would say we've been on the air a long time. This is probably 12 or 13 years ago. And he said, look, there's nothing, you can't compare anti-Semitism in America today compared to what it was when I was growing up. That's certainly true. But Europe has something else going on. Can you talk about that a little bit?
I can, but I'm also going to say that while I think that Dr. Dinnerstein is a very distinguished historian, I don't see the world in exactly the same way he does. He and I have both interpreted some of the same data showing that there are a significant number of incidents in higher education, and he has, I won't say he didn't take it seriously, but I would say that he gives it much less emphasis than I do. There's no question that anti-Semitism is much worse in Europe than it is in the United States. However, there's also no question that there have been many disturbing incidents of anti-Semitism on U.S. college campuses over the last several years, and it appears to be getting worse. My fear is that if we don't take action now, things will be as bad on American college campuses in 10 years as they are in English college campuses today, and that in 10 years, things will get as bad in England as they are in the Middle East. So things are definitely worse in Europe than they are here, but we're not going in the right direction.
In looking at anti-Semitism and the anti-Zionism connection, is there a way to distinguish it? Because it sure seems like people in America try to do that all the time.
There is. People throw their hands up and they say, you know, you just can't distinguish it, and that's not true. On the one hand, there are people who say that any kind of criticism of Israel is anti-Semitic. Well, that can't be. There are lots of different ways of criticizing Israel. Just read Haaretz. Nobody criticizes Israel like Israelis or American Jews.
That's right.
On the other hand, there are other people who take the extreme view that say that criticizing Israel has nothing to do with anti-Semitism. They're two different things. Well, that's also clearly false. There's no question, and there's certainly empirical evidence to demonstrate that much of the criticism of Israel has at its root negative attitudes towards Jews. So what we need are definitions and criteria that distinguish between the two. Now, there are different ways to do it. I've got a whole chapter on it in the definition of anti-Semitism. But to put it in a nutshell, I would say that Natan Sharansky had it basically right when he developed what he called the 3D test.
So what's the test?
According to the 3D test, something may be anti-Semitic if it involves double standards towards Israel, demonization of Israel, or delegitimization of the Jewish state. In other words, it's one thing just to give a political criticism, but to demonize Israel in the same way that the Jewish people were demonized, or to delegitimize the state, not just to criticize it, but to assert that the Jewish people have no legitimacy to national self-determination, that crosses the line.
So the large question, is the BDS movement in general anti-Semitic? Because it certainly seeks to delegitimize Israel.
Short answer is yes. Now, people ask me, well, does that mean that everyone who supports boycott, divestment, and sanctions is anti-Semitic? And the answer to that is clearly not. There are lots of people who have been duped into thinking that it is appropriate to boycott Israel based on some notion of what Israelis have or have not done to Palestinians. However, that's not what the BDS movement is all about. The BDS movement is a combined effort to marginalize, stigmatize, and delegitimize the Jewish state alone among nations of the world based on standards that are not used to any other country, and often using stereotypes and defamations that are simply the descendants of forms of hatred that have been directed against Jews for centuries.
It seems to me that being anti-Semitic in America is not acceptable and hasn't been now for a fair number of years. But being anti-Israel is okay, probably legitimately okay. When does that cross over?
We hear about anti-Semitism on college campuses all the time at the Louis D. Brandeis Center, and we are constantly calling university administrators to urge them to take action. If we find traditional anti-Semitism and we tell a dean or a president about it, they'll usually take action. If there is somebody with a Ku Klux Klan sheet over his head walking through campus, the university will act swiftly. However, there is what lawyers call a safe harbor. If you use just one magic word, you can get away with saying all of the worst kinds of anti-Semitic statements and doing what you please. And that word is Israel or Zionism. When haters speak in the guise of human rights or politics and speak not of Jews but of Zionists and Israelis, they can get away with some of the worst kinds of hate and prejudice because administrators simply don't know what to do about it. They throw up their hands and they say, we don't know. Is this anti-Semitism? Is it just anti-Zionism? Is it bias? Is it politics? And the safest, easiest thing for them to do is to do nothing, which is often what they do, which is why we need to go to work.
You know, it was fascinating. During the protests against the Gaza war last summer, we saw signs with the blood libel on them, claiming that Jews were eating Palestinian children. It was fascinating to see, I mean, in a horrible way, medieval anti-Semitic canards being circulated in what was supposed to be an anti-war protest.
We have on our website, BrandeisCenter.com, you can download some fact sheets with lists and descriptions of some of the canards and stereotypes historically that have been used against the Jewish people and how they're being used today against Israel. The blood libel is certainly one of the most common, and one sees it being used to this day against Israelis.
I want to thank Kenneth L. Marcus for a great visit here on Too Jewish on a very serious subject. His book is called The Definition of Anti-Semitism. You can find that online. You can also, what's the website for the Louis D. Brandeis Center?
It's www.brandeiscenter.com.
Great place to find out more. Thank you so much, and l'shana tova.
And the same to you. Thank you.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest, get a final musical playout.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday at 9 a.m. when our special guest will be two firefighters, one of whom went on a trip to Israel and met with Israeli firefighters. Interesting, fascinating, very different. Our playout this morning comes from the a cappella group 613. It's their original Rosh Hashanah song, Starting Over. My friends, have a Shavua Tov, a good week, but especially a Lashana Tova Umituka, a good and a sweet new year of 5776, which begins tonight. May it be a year, and of course a week, we pray, of peace.
It's Rosh Hashanah. All the time keeps ticking on. Just another year of moments come and gone. We're that much older, but are we wiser? Have our hearts grown that much colder? Part, 'cause I'm starting over, I'm looking back, 'cause I've done things that I'm not proud of, in this year we're coming out of, now's the time for introspection, time to forge a new direction, decide who I wanna be, a brand new year, a brand new me, 'cause I'm starting over. Blow the shofar.